Today is the 26th of February 2015 and I'm here to interview Carola Regent. Good afternoon, Carola. Could I begin by asking you when you were born and where were you born?
I was born in Düsseldorf on the 5th of December 1925.
And what was your name at birth?
Well, my surname was Zirndorfer.
You came from a Jewish family. Can you tell us a bit about your family before you came to the UK, before everything changed?
Well, it wasn't a strict Jewish family at all. My father was a publisher and had many friends, Christian friends and so on. We weren't strict, we weren't kosher. Very happy childhood we had.
And what sort of things did you do at the weekends? What were your interests at the time?
Well, when I was young like that, when my father used to take us for lovely walks up on the hills every Sunday while Mummy cooked the dinner and played. In those days, we still played on the street a game called Völkerball. You know, a whole crowd of us used to, there were very few cars, and skipping and on the street we used to mark, what do you call it,
hopscotch,
and skipping and roller skating and later ice skating. And
were your friends Jewish and Christian?
I think they were all Christian around us, you know.
And did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, a younger sister, Lottie, who's about 3.5 years younger.
And tell us a little about your schooling. You went to school in Düsseldorf?
No, in the first 4 years I went to where we lived, in Gerresheim, which is a suburb of Düsseldorf. I had a lovely time, awfully nice teacher. I think there were 50 of us in the class, you see.
50? My goodness.
I know, but somehow that's how, mm-hmm. You know, we were all divided up into sections, you know, inside. Mm-hmm. And a very, very, very nice teacher who was, even when the Nazis came and things were difficult, she sort of stuck by us and sort of protected us, you know, in the mornings when everybody had to stand up in class and say, Heil Hitler. She said, you needn't do it. And, you know, very, very protective of me.
Were you the only Jewish girl in the class?
I don't remember. I think probably yes.
And what happened at the end of your primary education? Could you join the rest and go on to the secondary school?
Well, that's the thing I couldn't do. I had to go to the Jewish school.
Was that close to where you lived, or did you
have
to travel?
No, it wasn't. We lived in a suburb, and I had to go by a tram to that school.
Did you find that very disturbing at the time, or were you quite happy to move on to the Jewish school?
Well, you see, I finished my 4 years, mm-hmm. So I had to have a change anyway. So, no, you know, it wasn't a big deal.
Well, you had to change trams in the middle of Düsseldorf.
Pardon?
You do have to change trams in the middle of
the
city.
Ah, yes, that was quite a thing, because I was still fairly young and I had to go and change trams to get to the Jewish school.
So you would have been about 8 when the Nazis came to power. Were you aware, as young as that, of life changing for you?
When did they come to power? In 33. How old was I? I'm 33 or 25.
Eight years old.
Do you remember things changing at that point?
Oh, yes, indeed.
What do you remember?
Well, I remember that the SA is used to, on a Sunday morning, march through the street, and people always stood and watched and so on, and, you know, Heil Hitler and all that. And the young people, you know, of my own age, they joined and singing, and, you know, it was all very jolly, but, I mean, for them. So I usually, we kept out of the way when they marched through. I don't remember a great deal of unpleasantness, except, yes, at a certain time, they never did anything specific, but I remember one occasion when I was coming back from a walk or something, and I wanted to go into our house, and all the young boys and girls or something, the ones who fell under the spell of Nazism, were sitting on the steps leading to our front door. And I didn't really know what to do. But I stood just opposite on the pavement, didn't do anything for a while, and then another person who lived in the house upstairs was going in, so I quickly joined him and went in through the door. And they never did anything, but there was always this threat, you know, and a feeling of no longer being part of things.
And how did your parents react?
To what?
To the changing situation.
Well, I mean, my father was very good. He used to travel to Düsseldorf and visit people and see how they were and so on. And that was a fortunate thing. And my mother and my sister and me, we'd gone for a walk. And we were coming back, and we saw the cars outside the Nazi car. And so we didn't go. We went back to some friends and waited till they had gone, which was a good thing. My father was away visiting, helping people. So I don't know what they'd come for, whether to arrest us or what. Anyway, they didn't come back. So that was...
Did the children play with you as they always had done?
What?
Did the children play with you as they always had done?
No, because they came under the influence of some young people who are very strong Nazis. My special friend... She sometimes, when the coast was clear, used to come, but my father said she shouldn't, because for her sake.
So did you find a lot of the time you were playing with your sister?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, we had good games. Yes, we had lots of games we played. Yes, I played with her sister. And also, when I went to the Jewish school, you see, I made friends, and then we had mm-hmm. contact with other.
And did your father, was he able to keep his job? What happened to him and his business?
No, they were very, very good and loyal, but he left, because it would have endangered them too if he'd gone on.
His staff?
Hmm?
Endangered his staff, the people who worked for him?
The firm he worked for, yes. So, but he did sort of still do work, but not with them, you see.
This was a sympathiser, wasn't it? Have you told me before that someone found him work of a different sort, much less interesting than he had done?
Yes.
And so this is how he managed to survive. But they had to give up, you told me that they had to give up jewellery and watches and all sorts of things like that.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, there came an edict that the Jews had to give up all their jewellery and take it along. But we'd given some of the very nicest family to some friends, Christian friends, and the girls, they travelled to England and France and so on. So some of the things were taken out. Yes.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm. And what happened at the time of Kristallnacht in 1938? Was your family affected then?
Yes.
What happened?
Oh, well, it was terrible. I'll read you a few lines. I'd written it down here.
This is from your book called The Ninth of November.
Yes. It must have been 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when suddenly I was ripped out of my sleep by the sound of smashing crockery in glass. On and on it went. At first I thought I must be dreaming still. But now it sounded as though the whole china cupboard had been hurled down, with everything in it exploding. It was coming from the kitchen. I don't know what I thought. Burglar? Earthquake? Lottie? She too was awake, and both of us were out of our beds, out of our room, flying into our parents' room a few doors along the passage. But it was no longer a haven. My father, in his nightshirt, stood speechless beside the bed. He was on his way to fetch us. My mother was sitting up, her black hair streaming over her shoulders, her eyes wild with fear. She gathered us into the bed with calming sounds. Seconds later, there burst into our room a horde of violent monsters, their faces contorted into raving mouths of hatred, some red, some pale, all screaming and shouting, eyes rolling, teeth bared, wild hands flailing, jackboots kicking. They were wielding axes, sledgehammers, stones and knives. They rushed about the room, smashing, throwing, trampling. It seemed to me that there were hundreds of them bursting through the door, though I believe there were only about a dozen. A chair hurled into the wardrobe mirror, glass flying everywhere. Crouching in bed, I saw a monster with a knife blade shining, screaming towards a painting on Daddy's side of the bed. It was a valuable painting, a very beautiful landscape, in which my father took great joy. Around me there was tumult, noise, confusion, but suddenly all my attention became fixed. My whole being became focused on my father's pathetic figure in his nightshirt, moving towards the painting as if to shield it. "Not that, not that," I heard him plead. And then, just as in a nightmare in which everything is happening in slow motion, and in which one is paralyzed and helpless at the crucial moment, I saw one Nazi pick up a large marble slab from the smashed dressing tabletop. He raised it high above his head. In that split second, as he threw it across the room with all his might at my gesticulating father, I had a momentary vision of him being smashed to the ground. But my father had ducked instinctively and retreated to the bedside, watching, now speechless, as another Nazi dug his knife blade deep into the canvas, slashing and hacking it as though he wanted to fell the staunchly painted summer oak. Well, now fear became a living thing, fear for the life and safety of my parents, who represented my own safety. It was like drowning. I sat numbed and in shock, watching without sound as axes flew into the screaming wood of chests and wardrobes. The one who had hurled the marble slab hardly stayed to watch the result, but frothing at the mouth, he found new sport in splintering doors, window frames, and driving his axe into the wall and floorboards.
That must have been so traumatic an experience for you.
Yeah.
And that, and what happened after?
Well,
when
there was another little bit which was rather touching, and you know, we were all paralysed, but then there came to the side of our bed a small man, outwardly the same, brown shirt, leather belt, jack boots, but he had a face, not a distorted mask, and he had human eyes and that saw our fear. He bent low and whispered, "Children, don't look, children, hide your eyes, I'm sorry, I had to do it." And somehow he drew the fanatic horde of raving animals from our room and drew them away, smashing and slashing in other rooms. Quite suddenly, our room was empty and we were all still alive. No one moved, the sounds continued a while, and then there was silence, though my mind still heard the noise. But there was silence, complete and sudden, with only the broken furniture groaning and settling into place. We listened to the silence for a long time, not daring to breathe, expecting them to return any minute to kill us, but they did not return.